Hi, everyone, and welcome to MedEdge. I'm Marcus Grimm. You know, whether you're a patient, a caregiver, or someone in the industry of training future caregivers, we all know about the pressing shortages in healthcare, shortages that are increasingly becoming more prevalent as our nation ages. But age isn't the only way we're changing as a society. The percentage of the U.S. population that speaks Spanish also continues to rise. And for those patients, well, the pressure's even worse. They're looking for care in an industry with acute shortages and a small percentage of healthcare professionals who can effectively communicate with them. How can healthcare adapt given these demographic trends? Before we welcome our guest, though, Tosh, this is something that I know you've been exposed to. You currently do rotations in Philadelphia. You practice in other areas. Just talk about some of the pressures that you've seen in the workplace from physicians that maybe can't communicate effectively with Hispanic patients.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Marcus, for that intro. And Alexandra, it was really great to meet you and looking forward to hearing more about your work. Yeah, I'd love to speak about my experience both as a resident and a medical student, and now as an attending physician in emergency radiology. Emergency medicine is something that I was interested in, and even in medical school, even though I didn't go into emergency medicine, I went into radiology. I spent a lot of time in New York City emergency rooms. And in New York City, especially in Brooklyn, New York, where I did my rotations, there is a lot of Hispanic patients. And when they come to the hospital, you have to take a history from that patient. And if you don't know how to speak Spanish, the only option is to go find a interpreter's phone at that time. And then you have to call the interpreter line and they would go back and forth. It's a very fragmented communication. And I always felt like I was only getting a piece of the story. And then there's a big delay associated with that too, because you have one or two phones in the ER, someone else may be using it, and then you're waiting. And then when you need to also communicate to the family members, you're stuck in that same situation. Recently, I even in Philadelphia, as an emergency radiologist, I had that situation where I had a patient that needed to get approval for getting a scan. She was pregnant and we need to make sure that she's okay with us giving contrast. And when I went and talked to the patient, we're scrambling to find the phone, first of all, because that's not something that we typically do in the radiology department. And eventually it took a while for us to get the scan because of that delay. If I had known Spanish, or if my resident had known Spanish, that probably would have happened a lot faster, avoided some delays and got that scan done faster for that patient.
It's a huge challenge. And I think as our guest today is going to share with us, it's a challenge that's only getting larger as the Hispanic population in our country grows, which brings us to today's guest. She's going to be talking about potential solutions to this challenge. Alexandra Lopez Vera is an assistant professor of medical education and the director of the medical Spanish program known as VIDA at the California University of Science and Medicine, where she prepares future physicians to provide culturally sensitive, high-quality care to Hispanic patients. Additionally, she creates and teaches medical Spanish courses for residents and mentors other scholars on effective methodologies for teaching medical Spanish courses. Her research interests are centered around enhancing linguistic and racial concordant healthcare quality for underserved populations. Alexandra's academic background includes a PhD in applied linguistics from the University of California, Santa Barbara, and a Master of Public Health from Claremont Graduate University. We've got a great video about VIDA. We're going to start with that today, so we'll go to that.
The VIDA program is a medical Spanish program that we have here at CUSM. Students see the contents in clinical case, then they see it in clinical skills, and 1 week after, they come to the medical Spanish sessions, and we review the exact same content that they learned in the clinical skills in Spanish.
For us, this often looks like taking what we learn in our clinical skills component of our curriculum here at COSM and then transferring into Spanish, thinking about how to deliver those same commands, requests, suggestions, etc., to patients that is going to be necessary for caring for them.
We flipped the script on how Spanish is being taught. So normally it's very focused on grammar, and it's like you hammer down the grammar of, you know, yo, tú, ustedes, whatever. And it's like, that's not really how you learn a language. And like, that's why I'm so thankful with the VIDA program. We've really restructured it to be clinical based, and we sprinkle in the grammar with it. So then you can start to see what sounds right.
And so this is a long undertaking because this runs in parallel with our systems based curriculum at CUSM, meaning when we're studying, say, the endocrine system, we're going to start studying how to tell patients about how to manage diabetes and how to do things like that, because it's related to that system. And this runs all throughout the year. In this way, we hope that it's integrated with what students are learning in the classroom and in the clinical skills. That way, they aren't learning two completely different things at a time. So Spanish is sort of auxiliary onto what you're already learning in the classroom.
Here in San Bernardino County, Hispanics form over 53% of the population. So it's a compromise that we have with our future physicians to teach them medical Spanish so that they can serve the Hispanic population in this area.
Of course, all of us on the team and at the school believe that care should be at the level of what the patients can understand and can relate to and connect to. You can't do that without language.
In the VIDA program, we teach not only linguistic content, but also cultural perspectives. So we want to make our patients, our Hispanic patient population, to feel comfortable. And for that, it's essential to learn components of the culture that Hispanic people have in every country or even in every region.
The VIDA program is particularly important to the CUSM community because over at Arrowhead Hospital, our partnership, a majority of the patients do speak Spanish. And I just see the look in a patient's eye when you walk in the room and they realize you speak Spanish, and it just makes such a difference in the patient-physician interaction. So that's why I'm so passionate about making sure that my peers can communicate in their native language.
So that they can connect with their patient, not only linguistically, but also in cultural, in a cultural way. For example, Hispanic people tend to appreciate more the physical contact, while in other cultures, they don't like it that much. So we have to teach what Hispanics prefer, and especially in every region, in every country, so that our future physicians can assist in the best possible way to Hispanic patients.
Alexandra, welcome to the program. We are thrilled to have you on MedEdge.
Thank you very much. I'm very excited to share with you guys what we have been doing at CUSM. So thank you for having me here.
Alexandra, your background is fascinating. We love having people on the show who have really diverse backgrounds, and you have experience both in public health, but also linguistics. I'm super curious, how did that happen? Which of those came first? How did you arrive where you are now?
Thank you very much for that question. My love for languages really kicked off from a young age, leading me to study not just in Spain, where I am originally from, but also in different countries such as Ireland, England, Canada, and the United States. So I studied 2 undergraduate degrees in Spain. So during those 8 years, I had time to explore the world, and I had many exchange opportunities in the countries I just mentioned. So each place was like a new chapter for me in understanding how languages shape our connections with people and also the cultures, that even if we speak the same language, we have different cultures. It was more than just academic. So it was about seeing the world through different lenses. And then I was very interested in learning more about that. So I was hoping from one country to another, I realized that language isn't just about communication, but it's also a key to unlock better healthcare experiences. I was always interested in healthcare experiences. I never thought about healthcare as a profession. It was something that I like to learn. And in Spain, we have a very good healthcare system. So I was always with connections that I had in healthcare, asking questions, researching myself. So all this interest and my studies, I studied education and linguistics as undergraduate, and I connected everything together, and this is very interesting. Then I went to West Virginia University. That's where I got my first master's. And I was there. I met a lot of nice people. They have a very strong medical school there. So for me, it was all very interesting, but you know, I didn't see it as a profession in that moment, but I was studying linguistics and also teaching Spanish to medical students at West Virginia University. After that, I applied for my PhD and I went to California, where Spanish and English coexist. And I realized that there is a lot to do there for the Spanish speaking populations. So I finished my PhD and I got this position at CUSM, California University of Science and Medicine. And then here I am. Well, I am finishing this semester my Master of Public Health. So I haven't earned it yet, but I am almost there. In May, I will have my Master of Public Health. So that's it.
Congratulations. That's a tremendous accomplishment. And I'm glad you mentioned that even somebody who was born in Spain and then obviously knows the language inside out, it's fascinating to me that your eyes were really open to what's necessary in healthcare when you went to California. We have some statistics here. In the 1980s, Hispanic population was approximately 6% in the United States. Some studies say it's 13% now, and it might go to 30%. But I kind of get the sense that averages don't matter as much as what's happening in our own backyard. And where you are currently working, the number is well exceeds 30%. Tell us about the Hispanic population where you are.
As you mentioned, Marcus, the demographic landscape in the United States is confusing, but it's indeed shifting. And the increasing Spanish-speaking population is a significant part of this change. National figures do not provide a broad overview. You know, sometimes it's difficult to quantify. But here, where I am, I'm in San Bernardino County, which, by the way, is the biggest county in the entire nation by kilometers or miles in extension, right? So here, we're also in the Inland Empire region, which is more inland. So California has a lot of coast, but this is the Inland Empire. And here, Spanish-speaking people make up for over 60% of the total population. And out of this 60% of the total population, there is a big percent. I think it's 39. I don't want to say 100%, but that's what I remember, of people who just speak Spanish. So the numbers are very significant. So a considerable portion of this population only speaks Spanish or has Spanish preferences, right? And this shapes the healthcare needs and services of this area, underscoring the importance of linguistic and cultural competency in health provision.
What are some of the ways that we currently tackle these challenges? Tosh mentioned, what did you call it, Tosh? A translator? This is a new term. Was it a translator device or what did you call it?
Interpreter phone, yeah.
In areas with a high Hispanic population or any other population that speaks a different language other than English, solutions are like hiring bilingual staff, also using medical interpreting services, providing medical Spanish in medical schools, as we do here. I have to also point out at the big work that some healthcare providers do in studying on their own, taking their own time to try to overcome these barriers on their own. But these are one of the steps taken by healthcare facilities or medical schools to overcome this situation.
So you have a lot of disparate solutions that are out there, which brings me to my next question for you. You were one of the authors of a paper that was published last year, Comprehensive Medical Spanish Curriculum Model, the VITA Medical Spanish Curriculum. And in that paper, you acknowledge that as many as 78% of the U.S. medical schools offered some form of medical Spanish program in 2019, yet only a little bit more than a fifth of those met the standards of medical Spanish education. Those standards were revised most recently in 2020. So while a lot of efforts are being made towards this issue, there are some gaps, I guess, in some of the programs that are out there. What are those gaps that you found that you're seeking to address?
There are many, 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 many gaps. But if I had to point out one, it will be the assessment. So we need a standardization in the assessment method for medical Spanish programs. And I'm sure that Tosh can affirm this. So right now in most hospitals, residents, medical students, physicians have to self-declare if they speak Spanish, and then they will see Spanish-speaking patients. We need a standardization. So now there are many experts, medical Spanish experts, working on a tool that is going to be, I think it's called Physician Oral Language Observation Matrix, POLOM. And it's going to assess the medical Spanish of physician or healthcare providers to make sure that they are sufficient or they are able to meet with Spanish-speaking patients without being interpreters. Because what happens when a physician is also an interpreter is that they can be used, understand what I mean, by other healthcare providers. And then, you know, they can lose the focus of what they actually have to do. So this assessment method that a lot of experts are working on right now is supposed to solve this problem and also to protect the healthcare provider, saying, okay, I'm certified by this company that I am able to see you on my own. And if there's a problem, there's always someone who is protecting both ways. And also another problem is that, in my opinion, is that medical Spanish programs sometimes are just Spanish programs. It's different. It's a different feel within Spanish, but it's a different branch. So I teach medical Spanish, which means I teach what my future physicians need to see patients. I'm not going to teach you conjugations and this, and I'm going to teach you what you need in this 18-month curriculum, the most necessary things you need to learn. So, for example, I teach the subjunctive mood, which is something difficult to acquire, difficult to understand for Spanish students. But I teach it very early in the very first year because or future physicians give recommendations, suggestions, express desires to their patients. So it's something they need to learn. In a normal sequence of Spanish course, you will not learn this structure until you are a very advanced speaker or a student. So I think that's another mistake that some programs may have, is that they try to teach Spanish and also students lose interest. They are studying medicine. So if you're teaching Spanish, some of them are not good at it. And you know how medical students are. They like to be good at what they do because they're used to that feeling, right? So they're going to have these feelings of, I don't like this. You know, what am I doing this? So I think the assessment is the most important part, but also to make sure that the students see why they need it. And let me add, for example, at CSM, we have the Inland Empire Free Clinic. It's a clinic run by students. And I go there every shift. And students see what we see in the classroom there from the very first year. And also they are in a location where, as I said before, a lot of people speak Spanish. So for them, it's a very good way of seeing the reality. They don't have to wait till they go to residency or to rotations to see the need. You know, they see it from the very beginning.
Have this program been required for a year already, or is this becoming required?
Thank you for that question. It's about to become a requirement starting July 2024 for the class of 2028.
So for that, what do you see in terms of student response to this? I, for example, understand the importance of language, having grown up in cities like New York City and Philadelphia. Other students that may have come from different parts of the country and may want to go back to those areas to practice, what do you think the students will react to having to require to take Spanish? Because whenever you add something to the medical curriculum, something else has to go away because you only have 4 years. You have to fit everything into there. I'd love to hear your thoughts on if there's sort of some sort of selection that'll happen where students that come to CUSM will be interested in that or how that will change.
This is very complicated. I appreciate the question. And also, it's not just the students, it's also other doctors, other professors, right? Everyone has the same concerns. So I think the fact that CUSM is located in this location and gives us a reason to have it. And also it's part of our mission. Our mission is to serve the communities where we are located, right? So I would say that this was approved to become a requirement last year. And we didn't do it because some people had already accepted their mission. And we didn't inform them, right? So we are waiting another year to do it so everyone knows. By the reactions, for example, we have received feedback from students. Right now, we just have one course, so there are no levels. So as I said, I teach medical Spanish. I'm not teaching Spanish as such. It's Spanish, but it's medical Spanish. So all the students are in the same group. Some of them already had studied Spanish before, others hadn't. So I have everyone together. I provide supplemental materials, but everyone is together. So one of the criticisms by students is having different proficiency levels is something we are doing for next academic year to have a beginner and an intermediate group. The content is going to be the same. What is going to change is the way I deliver the content. For the beginner, I will speak in English a little bit. For the intermediate, I will just speak Spanish, but the content will be the same. Why? Because I have created this curriculum that is, as I said, medical Spanish, Spanish speaking for physicians, and it's 18-month curriculum that is parallel to clinical skills. So it's not something new. So what I want to tell my students, especially to those who are afraid or have doubts about having to study a language in medical school, is it's going to be parallel to clinical skills. So it's not something new. The things you learn in clinical skills, obviously more light, this is Spanish, medical Spanish, but the structures that go with those things you have to convey. For example, we are in the reproductive system. In second year, this is the first block or system you study in second year. And you go to medical school, to medical Spanish class, and I teach you reflexive verbs. Why? Because, for example, we talk about inflamarse, hincharse, to swell, los testículos. Por ejemplo, important topic. So we learned this structure, which is the reflexive verbs in that context. And then I give you supplemental materials and we practice those verbs in a topic that you are studying in clinical skills. So what I tell them is, don't worry, I will show them the numbers. We have, I think last November, we had our OSCE, Medical Spanish OSCE for the class of 2026. and out of 65 students, only 4 fail. And it was not a requirement. Attendance was not mandatory. So just by coming to class and studying a little bit, it's not difficult and it's parallel to clinical skills. So I'm still ready to hear criticism, to learn, to improve. So I think every concern needs to be addressed. And that's what I will try to do when they come.
I really like how you presented that, because I didn't think about it that way when I was hearing you also, because it's being parallel with what they're doing in the clinical skills, because you are learning in one class how to take those histories. Me being an attending now, I'm looking at, like, I have to think about learning a whole new language. But when I'm learning those clinical skills and then going to another class right after and saying, this is how you do it in Spanish, that's much easier to process and sort of immersing them in that experience. So that, I think that it's a lot less overwhelming than having to take class on its own outside of that context.
It's like the medical Spanish field has both medical experts and language experts, and both have to work together for the clinical skills content and the sequence that the students have to follow. That's medical, right? Medical experts. But for me, it's the way we teach the language and also the sequence, because even though we vary the sequence compared to normal Spanish classes, still has to make sense, because the brain takes time to learn a language and it has to be taught in a specific way with specific materials. And also we have to understand the goal that our students have. Our students don't expect to master the language flawlessly. They expect to be functional and capable to assist the medical Spanish population. So that's what we have to keep in our focus.
How do you layer in it? And I think this comes from the video that we saw, that this isn't just about language, right? It's about cultural training as well. So does cultural training become part of the medical Spanish curriculum, or how do you integrate that?
So language and culture have to be together. So even though there are, I think, 20 countries that have Spanish as their first language, I am from Spain, which is across the ocean. So my culture, even if I speak Spanish, is totally different from the Mexican, the Colombian. Even in different regions, as I said in the video, we have different cultures. So what I try to do is to give them a glimpse of different cultures in the Hispanic population. I also ask my students to reflect on the term Hispanic. Why do we have this term? Hispanic is a person who has Spanish as their first language. Do we have that word for people who speak English? We don't. So I try that they understand that there are a lot of things that should be addressed and are not addressed. Also, we have a lot of people from South America, Central America, who don't identify as Hispanic or Latino. They don't. They don't like these terms. They identify as, you know, other indigenous or, you know, other categories. So I want my students to understand that when we teach culture, there are as many cultures, as many regions or countries, or even people, you know. So it's just to give them a glimpse and to reflect on their own culture so that they are more open to differences. One of the things we teach, for example, is bias. In some countries, there is bias against female physicians or Black physicians. There are bias. So we try to explore those, give them scenarios and ask them how they will react, and then give them points of view of why this happens. So they understand that it's personal against them. The person carries their own biases, insecurities, culture, and they can navigate these situations better that they may encounter when they are physicians.
Tosh, I have a question for you. When you think about your medical school training, these are fascinating topics, right? Bias and culture, and really it's all about how to empathize and communicate with people. Was that a big part of your learning, or are these some new things that we're seeing?
In my experience, and I'm sure most medical students, it all depends on your mentor or your preceptor that you're working with. Once you get into clinical training, it's more apprentice-based training, and you're working with someone, and their strengths and their weaknesses and their biases is often what's passed down to the trainee. And that's one of the strengths and the weaknesses of medical education, because I work with my resident, I show them how I do things and say, this is the right way to do things. And then he or she may do the same thing to their training. So it is kind of nice to have a professional like you, Alexandra, that is trained in these kinds of biases and cultural elements that physicians should be aware of to look at it objectively and speak to that.
Something interesting also is, for example, gender-affirming language. So we are teaching medical Spanish language, right? So what happened if we have a patient that uses non-binary pronouns, or, you know, that needs help with this? So I like to give the tools to my students so that they know how we do it in Spanish, especially because we're in California, and it's a very important topic in our state and in the whole nation. But it's just so that they understand that it evolves so fast. There are trends, and this is not political. This is about assisting people. If a person, you're going to make their life or their day better just by using the correct non-binary pronouns in Spanish, why wouldn't you learn them, right? It doesn't matter what you believe. It doesn't matter what you think. It's about your patient. And another thing, when Tosh was talking, that I thought of is, many students come to COSM and say, hey, I really speak Spanish. Do I have to take Vida in medical Spanish? And Tosh said something that I agree with. Yes. Why? Because this is a new language. You may know Spanish, but, you know, medicine is a new language. I'm sure you know. It's something you have to learn. Even if you speak English, you have to learn many things, many vocabulary, many words. So in medical Spanish, it's the same. You may know Spanish, but there are many cultural things you're going to learn. There are many words, expressions you're going to learn here. It's not just about the language. It's everything together. That's why I tell my students, if you know Spanish, that's a plus for you. It's good for you. But you're going to benefit from this course too.
I think it's amazing how much your program has grown in a very short period of time. Just a few years ago, it was a peer program. Then it becomes an elective program. Now it's going to be a required program. We have to ask you, what's next on the list? What are you trying to accomplish? What's next for this program?
For me, this sounds so typical, but for me, the sky's the limit. So we are going to adapt to whatever our Spanish-speaking population, in this case, needs in the region where we are located. So we have a curriculum already created, right? But I am open to change any aspect of it that needs to be changed as, you know, as medicine evolves, as our population changes. So that's one of the things that I keep in mind. Second, I am working on a textbook right now, a textbook that is medical Spanish parallel with clinical skills. So one of my goals, when I finish the MPH, because right now I'm working full time, I'm studying full time, which has been very difficult. So as soon as I finish the MPH this May, what I want is to, you know, keep working on that textbook that I have 5 chapters written. I need other 5 chapters, and then publish that so that my students have that when they come to me. That right now I provide every material, but I am creating that textbook. And also, as I said, trying to be up to date with what the Spanish speaking population needs. Something that I would like to have for my students, we already have it, but I would like to have it in a bigger way, is the possibility to go to Spanish speaking countries. They already have the option, but there are not as many opportunities as I would like to have, so that they can practice and rotations, medicine, whatever they can abroad. Many students do it already, but that's something that I have in mind. And just to grow. Right now, we are trying to have POLOM, the Physician Oral Language Observation Matrix Assessment Method. So that's something also in my to-do list, to approve the budget for that, to make sure my students have it when it's released. So there are many things. So I can always be saying things. So many things that we want to achieve as USM and Vida.
Alexander, you've been speaking a lot about how this is starting to show up in medical education and how schools are starting to make this a requirement. What do you see as your vision for the future of healthcare? What would be an ideal solution down the road? And I would also love to hear your thoughts on artificial intelligence and how companies are coming up with products that can do real-time translation and how that fits into this future.
I think that medical Spanish courses or program don't necessarily need to be a requirement for every medical school. It will depend on the population that they serve in the location they are located. So for one like mine, like COSM, I think it's expected to have medical Spanish as a requirement because more than half of the population identifies as Hispanic or Latino and speaks Spanish. But I see this as something that more medical schools are going to continue to do as the Spanish-speaking population continues to grow, because the numbers are there, and every year we have more Spanish-speaking people in the United States. So that's something that I think is going to start happening. It's already happening. I think last year was the first time a medical Spanish program was a requirement. This new academic year is going to be a second one. So I think it's something that little by little is happening. And I think artificial intelligence will play an important role. Right now, we have standardized patients in every session. So I think that maybe artificial intelligence can be part of that. So I think it's good to keep the personal component, but it's true that artificial intelligence can imitate everything. And I'm sure that it gets better. It's going to be even better. So I think it's a good tool that we have to learn how to use. So right now, I'm taking a course that is teaching with artificial intelligence. So I'm trying to learn how can I implement this with my students when we have the resources to do it. And I think it's something that we cannot look to other side because it's here to stay. So I think it can assess the current proficiency level of a medical student and help them from that baseline to improve. So I see this as something that is going to be in medical schools. So not only for medical Spanish, but also for other fields. But for my field, I am 100% convinced it's going to be there. And I don't know how long it will take, but it's a matter of time.
Alexander, this has been
fun.
Seeing people operating at the intersection of healthcare, demographic changes. We brought in technology there at the end. You are right in the middle of everything. Congratulations on the great work that you're doing and that your team is doing. I'm certain we're going to have listeners that will say, well, I'm part of the 78% that has medical Spanish, but wow, we want to up our game. What's the best way for them to reach out to you?
We're on social media. So Vida has an Instagram account, which is CUSM Vida. My name is Alexandra Lopez Vera. I have LinkedIn. I have my own website where I can also get some, you know, questions, and also my email at CSM, which is my name, period, my last name at csm.edu. So any of those ways work for me. And I am here also. I like having interviews with other medical Spanish professionals. They can achieve and do what we are doing or even more. So this is just having the support by the institution, by the dean, and by every professor in the, you know, at CSM that we are doing this. Without their support, we wouldn't be where we are.
Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a lot of fun. When we talk about the choices tomorrow's healthcare professionals have, we often look through that lens of whether or not they'll go into private practice or research or technology. And sometimes we forget that each of those choices spawns their own possibilities, where they'll practice and the skills that will make them more effective given those decisions. Programs like VITA address those drawn to our ever-increasing Hispanic communities and reflect how healthcare education must continue to adapt to respond to those changes within those communities. We're grateful to Alexandra and all the professionals providing those opportunities for the medical leaders of tomorrow. You've been enjoying MedEdge. MedEdge is a program brought to you by Medtrix. Medtrix, practice medicine, not software. Learn more at medtrixlab.com. For everyone on the MedEdge team, I'm Marcus Grimm.